This is tape 4 of the PDH online course, Industrial HVAC Control Case. I said case because I'm very clearly limiting the discussion to one particular installation and one particular set of equipment. A more comprehensive course would talk about all of the available forms of supply fans, all of the available forms of exhaust fans, all the types of makeup air units, all the types of PLCs, all the different switch combinations. We're going to get a little bit into limit switches if we didn't, but there are 100 kinds of limit switches, and it would be a worthwhile discussion, but it's not the discussion we're pursuing today. Where we broke off, we were talking about enunciators, and this session starts with a sidebar: why invest in alarm lights and enunciation? Alarm lights and enunciation are fairly recent innovations. I was in charge of HVAC controls maintenance for a large state university, in fact, in the 1990s. Most of the buildings were from the 1950s and 1960s, or had HVAC renovations then. The standard installation had fans with local controls and large air handlers, similar to the MUAs we will discuss next. The large air handlers each had one or more motor starters hanging on the wall and individual remote limit switches, pressure switches, and thermostats. No indicators or enunciators beyond occasional strips of ribbon hanging from supply air registers. And that's a little joke. I don't know if you picked up on that. We usually think of status indicators as being electronic. In HVAC, the most effective status indicator is a piece of ribbon hanging from a supply register. And the reason I know this, I got a lot of complaints from users, people in the buildings being served, that the HVAC wasn't working. And I got in the habit of climbing up on a desk with a piece of scotch tape and 6 inches of ribbon and hanging it from their supply register. They could see it flapping in the wind, and I didn't get any more phone calls that the HVAC wasn't working. While I was in controls maintenance, I found 3 lost fan rooms that had tripped out on one of the safeties and not been recognized and not been reset. Obviously, the filters had not been changed in many years, but that was also true of many of the fan rooms still in service. And there's a joke there. I don't know if you enjoy my sense of humor or not, and it's probably a bad form for me to laugh at my own jokes, but we had a lot of trouble with filters. The guy who changed filters didn't much like changing filters, so he got a schedule and did as many as he felt like doing, and then he went home, or he went wherever he went and clocked out at the right time. We had a lot of filters that didn't get changed. We found this out when he moved on to a better job, and the guy that replaced him was using a lot more filters than the first guy was. Okay, a typical makeup air unit. Now, this is a sketch, and it's kind of a jokey sketch because I didn't describe any of the components that make up the makeup air unit. I made a picture of a big dashed box with a disconnect safety switch on the outside, the inlet through the outside air on the outside, and the discharge inside, a local control panel connected to a remote control panel, and that's all there is. Now, the reason is, this is a 2010 makeup air unit. You buy a factory fabricated device, you bring it in with a crane, drop it on the roof, and hopefully the guy punched a hole through the roof so it'll fit, and connect the wires. It is a packaged unit. There is not field wiring to be done. For which reason, I didn't dig into it much on what's inside it. Now again, in 1980, I knew what was inside it. And if I dig deeply enough into my memory, I may. And actually, I could go on the internet and find what's inside it again. And actually, it's going to be the same stuff that was there in 1980. It's just that it's a packaged unit. It doesn't require makeup or connection today, except a remote panel with wire A connected to terminal A, wire B connected to terminal B. As best I can tell, the 1993 and 2009 makeup air units were very similar. However, in 1993, the electrical designer had to run wiring and provide logic for the big fan, the direct fired burner and safeties, the filter, differential pressure switch, and any other accessories provided. In 2009, the unit was specified with single point power, and all the accessories and controls were provided and connected up by the unit manufacturer. The client, however, in this case, the 2010 case we're talking about, still wanted centralized alarms on unit failure, burner failure, dirty filter. The electrical designer responded by giving the electrical contractor a scope requirement of installing auxiliary relays on the makeup air unit controls to report to the enunciation panels. The mechanical designer was hiring a specialized temperature control contractor to handle details of the installation, and the temperature control contractor was to help the electrical contractor with the enunciation task. Sidebar: how to connect an auxiliary relay to controls packaged in the MUA. Well, first, we must recognize that the MUA is being bid against a very thin specification. That is, nothing about the controls was specified. If it's cheaper for the successful bidder to use relays internally, he will. If he chooses a shoebox PLC, he will. If he chooses a unitary HVAC controller, he will. The electrical contractor probably won't know until the unit is delivered. No one provides auxiliary contacts for status and alarms. Obviously, he has to bid his services at least 6 months before this time. Now, was that the fragmented logical presentation that I'm famous for? I think it was. I think I skipped back and forth between two threads. One thread is, we don't know what we're getting on the MUA. The specification didn't say what's in the MUA. Now, you could say it's got to have an Allen Bradley controller. You could say it's got to have a Johnson Unified controller, UNT, or no electronics are permitted. It can only be done by electromechanical relays. I think you'd have a hard time getting it built that way, but typically these people will take your money if you insist. So on one hand, we don't know what we're getting. The electrical contractor doesn't know what he's getting, but he's bidding a firm price on hooking up an auxiliary relay to it. That's kind of interesting. The 1993 way to meet this requirement was for the electrical contractor to purchase some relays, relay bases, and fairly large metal boxes. His men mounted the relay bases on a subpanel in the box, brought coil and contact leads to a terminal strip on the subpanel. Then his field people punched holes in the box for conduit entry and ran conduits and wires to the MUA controls and to the PLC. In 2009, there's an extremely economic, parsimonious, purchased component that simplifies this task to the field connections only. That is, all that's remaining is the field connections. It's called Relay in a Box. Now, this name is so pervasive that when you research on the internet auxiliary relay, you come back with huge numbers of relay in a box being sold by Square D, being sold by Johnson Controls, but it's all relay in a box that comes from Functional Controls, I think is the actual manufacturer. And also it's in the links on the internet, the download version of this, but the company's name is Functional Devices. It's an encapsulated relay with coil and contact conductors exiting through a conduit fitting. That is, you never see the relay. You don't have anything to mount. You don't worry about terminal strips. You worry about wire nuts. It can be mounted directly on the MUA control box or in a deep 4x4 junction box near the MUA control box. The hard part is getting the coil to match the indicator lights on the MUA control box. That is, the lights may be 24 volts, very common in HVAC stuff, or 110, which we're used to, or could actually be 5 volts if they've integrated digitally all the way. And I'm trying to remember if anybody I know has done that. I don't think I'm close enough to the field to know if anybody has actually gone to 5 volt logic on HVAC. It's unlikely because... Let me just bite my tongue and not say anymore. I don't know about it. I know that Johnson Controls makes a very nice package device. In every respect, it is a programmable logic controller, except it comes with canned HVAC programs in it, and all the terminals are defined in terms of HVAC devices. Okay, continuing on our saga, a typical cooling tower, and immediately we go into a sidebar. Tragedy. Cooling towers have changed. In 1993, people were still maintaining redwood cooling towers. The frame and slats were redwood because it would survive 20 years or more in service, immersed in water with freezing and thawing. It was easy to unbolt a connector and remove a damaged piece and replace it, more like Tinker Toys than Lincoln Logs. The 1993 purchase for the process was steel, also with a promised life approaching 20 years, but not component replaceable. Yes, you could buy a new fan or fan motor, and you had to buy new pumps, but the enclosure and structure were throwaway. In 2009, the new cooling tower will be steel also. When I wrote the course, I did an internet search and thought the fiberglass cooling towers were just the greatest thing since sliced bread. But they're not buying that. They're buying a steel one. The structure and airways will last 20 years or more. Steel connects the pieces and it will begin rotting away after 10 years and cause serious problems by 20 years. Even though intact and still beautiful, it will be throwaway. That's because renting a big crane for $10,000 a day is less expensive than maintenance for 10 years. A sketch of typical 1950s cooling towers follows. Now, by the way, you may think this is inappropriate, that nobody knows anything about redwood cooling towers today. You're absolutely right. I went around the office asking the mechanical engineers if they knew anything about redwood, and they said trees, only trees in California. A sketch of a typical 1950 cooling tower follows. The internals of steel or fiberglass units should be similar. Smaller cooling water demands today are often met by the use of glycol water mixture and a closed system with a fin tube heat exchanger on the outside instead of a cooling tower. By the way, they still call them cooling towers, and it's available in two forms, one with only the fan and one with the fan plus spray water. But the spray water is not part of the process piping circuit. There's a tank at the bottom and a little pump and a makeup, obviously, and you spray the water over it when you need it, and you turn it off when the air is cold enough that you don't need it. Okay, so we got a picture here, and it's got a big fan on the top. The way I know there's a big fan on the top was some years ago, I spent a lot of time crawling up these things, so they had a ladder on the side, and doing maintenance on the big fan on the top. One of the things they had up there was a vibration switch. A vibration switch was a little box with a ball bearing across two contacts, and when the thing shook enough, it shook the ball bearing off and the contacts were broken. They still come with a vibration switch, but it's an electronic accelerometer with a built-in alarm relay threshold on it, and it costs the same as the old thing with the it probably costs a little more than the thing with the ball bearing on it. And we've got a spray arrangement, and the spray arrangement clogs up because water gets hard and clogs it, and somebody has to go up with a steel brush periodically and clean it. And back in 1950, there was something called fill, and the purpose of that was to give you more surface area in contact with the air blowing through it rather than droplets. There's this cooling tower return pump that pumps water into the cooling tower. Now, that might sound wrong to you, but we're thinking process. And the cooling tower supply pump supplies cooling water to the process. The cooling tower water return pump returns water from the process. There's wiring and a safety disconnect, and what I'm calling a catch tank at the bottom. If you read about this on the internet, they say it's really better to move this tank inside where you don't have to worry about a heater on it. And maybe somebody does that. Hey, I don't know how you build cooling towers. I'm an electrical guy. But I'm calling it a catch tank, and it's an essential part of an open cooling tower that is one that actually sprays the water down. What do they call it? They don't call it a tank. Reservoir sump. They call it a sump. These are basic components. The structure, fan, water circuit, water pumps, and drain. Not shown are the accessories to permit it to operate in freezing temperatures. Not drain and survive, but keep working, delivering cooling water at the same temperature as in the summer. The first application of variable frequency drives came to cooling towers. It had always been a problem to maintain cooling water supply temperature in the face of changing outdoor temperatures and outdoor humidity, which greatly affects cooling tower efficiency. With the availability of variable frequency drives, you just connect a cooling water supply temperature transmitter to the PID control into the variable frequency drive, and the problem is gone. Obviously, there had been high temp and low temp alarms before, and they were kept. One of the strip charts in the present installation is the cooling water supply temperature. But variable frequency drives came in the 1970s. What did they do in the example 1950 cooling tower? A DC drive? No, I've worked with DC drives, and let me tell you, outside is not a good place for a DC drive. DC drives have always been a big hassle. You don't want to adjust the commutator brushes while wrapping your legs around the structure at the top of a cooling tower. Instead, there were a range of multi-speed motor configurations and more complicated motor starters to start and run them safely. I had a book of 20 pages of motor starter control circuits for cooling towers. I went back to the manufacturer to see if they still make that book. Manufacturer's been bought by an international conglomerate, and they have eliminated customer support as I knew it in the past. In addition, cooling towers in below freezing temperatures usually had momentary reverse operation to break loose and shake off ice. And by the way, they should be getting in the cooling tower for this project by the time I write part two of the course. So I'll tell you then what the motor controls were on the cooling tower they bought. I know they bought a two-speed motor instead of a variable speed because it was cheaper. And that kind of surprises me because my understanding of the market today was that variable frequency drives were cheaper than you have to pay a lot more to get a two-speed motor. You have to pay a lot more to get multiple contactors. You know, 100 or 50 horsepower, we're talking big contactors, and it costs more to get those. I thought a variable frequency drive was less expensive, but maybe that they don't want to undertake the maintenance on variable frequency drive. The rule on variable frequency drives is if you can get them to work once, they work for a long, long time. Now, I do know that everything in this plant is redundant. The air compressor is redundant. The pumps are redundant. The cooling tower is not redundant. I bite my tongue on this. The new one they're buying has two fans on it, so it is at least partially redundant. And again, it will be very interesting to see what they install, which I will share with you in part two of the course. Is the process continuous 24/7? And by the way, that's a good thing for a cooling tower because starting and stopping the water in sub-freezing temperatures is worrisome. If not, the controls must accommodate shutdown or minimum operation in the coldest part of the night. Heat trace, that is heating wires wrapped around the pipes, was standard, and catch tank heaters were common. Now again, I'm talking about Ohio where it's cold. The cooling towers are used in all climates, and obviously if it doesn't freeze in Arizona, you don't need freeze protection on the piping or in the tank. You must alarm on heat trace failure, and one of the strip charts for the current example was catch tank temperature. Trick question, does electric heat trace keep the water-filled pipe from freezing? And the answer is no. Electric heat trace with substantial insulation keeps the water-filled pipe from freezing. The electrical designer pays a lot of attention to the selection and installation of heat trace, especially fancy wrapping techniques at the valves and inline devices. It doesn't work, though, unless similar care is applied to the tightness of the pipe, the details of insulation installation, and the metal or plastic protective shell around the insulation. The 2009 cooling tower for this process is being selected by the client. That's why we don't really know yet, possibly to supply other processes. I believe you now appreciate the incentives to switch from an open system to a closed glycol-filled system. A package system is planned for the current design, with all design choices being made by the manufacturer to meet the performance requirements. As mentioned on the MUA previously, installing electrical contractor has been tasked with adding auxiliary relays to bring out alarms to the central annunciation panel. The temperature transmitter and strip chart recorder with temperature alarms will also be relocated to the new site. Now, we're going to spend some time talking about the strip chart recorders with a PLC and the temperature alarms with a PLC. So stay tuned for that. Also, stay tuned for a discussion of plant air compressors. That's what we're going to do in the next tape.